manifestation. Before the creation, there were no material minds or material eyes. Therefore, the mind by which the Supreme Personality of God had desired to create is transcendental. And the eyes with which he glanced over the material nature are also transcendental. Thus, the Lord's mind, eyes, and other senses are all transcendental. So the question is, what does this transcendental mean? What does transcendental mean? In America, we have a history of transcendentalism. And that's a different take, practically, on what is being presented here in this verse as transcendental. The Supreme Lord is one without a second, and he is in no way or form mundane, although he creates the mundane universe, the material world. He creates that, but in no way is he mundane. Generally, we think that one has to have a certain quality in order to become something or to create something. But the Lord is in complete control of everything, and therefore he has no need to become or to be, contaminated by mundane. And what does mundane mean? Mundane means that which is not of the transcendental or the spiritual nature, that which is material, that which is something that we actually despise. A true transcendentalist is someone who is in love with the ultimate transcendental person. As true transcendentalists, we despise the material nature. We want to get free from it. We use it in Krishna's service, but we try to keep ourselves completely detached from it. The mundane nature, mundane material nature, is basically giving us so many problems. If we analyze where are the problems of the world coming from, where are the problems I'm experiencing coming from, they're coming from the mundane nature of this material world. What does mundane mean? Mundane means without the Supreme, without recognition or understanding of the Supreme. Maya is mundane. Mundane means Maya. It means illusion. Actually, there is no mundane. Everything is transcendental. Krishna's nature is all-pervading. He's in every atom. So there is no, material in the sense that material is ultimately spiritual. But we don't see that. We're covered by mundane nature, by Maya. We're covered by illusion, and we see this world as separate from the Supreme Lord. We see the nature, material nature, as separate from the Supreme Nature. So this is our problem, and this was the problem that the transcendentalist, was considered America's first intellectual movement, the first American intellectual movement. It was certainly this first to inspire generations of American intellectuals, as well as a number of literary monuments, rooted in the transcendental philosophy of Immanuel Kant, the German idealism. So this idea that we could transcend, man has always been interested in going above the mundane and getting to a higher platform. And the transcendentalists did have in mind to cultivate a mentality of transcendence, of being above the mundane. But they took it in so many different ways. The transcendentalists found inspiration in philosophy in a variety of diverse sources, and one of them was the Vedic thought. Vedic thought and various German idealism. So the transcendentalists were a combination. They were eclectics. They were combining different ideas to put together a philosophy. Now, this philosophy lasted for about two decades. It wasn't very much appreciated. However, the quotes that we use in the Bhagavad Gita came from Thoreau, Henry David Thoreau. In Walden, he spoke of transcendental death, and we've heard this before, but this particular quote seems to be more accurate than the one we have printed in the Gita. In the morning, I bathe my intellect in the stupendous cosmogonal philosophy of the Bhagavad Gita, since whose composition years of gods have elapsed. And in comparison with our modern world and its literature, see, and its literature seem puny and trivial in comparison with which our modern world and its literature seem puny and trivial. And that's so incredibly true. That's amazingly accurate. And I doubt that if that philosophy is not to be referred to a previous state of existence so remote in its sublimity from our conceptions. So he's referring basically there was a previous time when we actually had a connection, you know, with previous lives. I doubt if that philosophy is not referring to a previous state of existence so remote is the sublimity from our conceptions. Sublimity. That's interesting. That's an interesting word. How completely lost we are to the subtle things that are going on around us. Krishna's complete control. We're lost to that. We don't see that. I lay down the book and go to my well for water. And lo, there I meet the servants of a Brahmin, a Brahmin priest, priest of Brahma and Vishnu and Indra, who still sits in his temple on the Ganges reading the Vedas, or dwells at the root of a tree with his crust and water jug. I meet his servant come to draw water for his master, and our buckets, as it were, grate together in the same well. The pure Walden water is mingled with the sacred water of the Ganges. It's very, very poetic and very flowery and a lot of word jugglery in many respects, but they were... They were trying to find out some ideas. It's interesting. I got some of this information on Wikipedia, and the dilemma that we have in spreading the transcendental, the true transcendental philosophy, it was just stunning to me. I looked into the Wikipedia about the transcendentalists, and then there was a section on Bhagavad Gita. You know, it mentioned, you know, they highlight all these things. So I went to Bhagavad Gita, and then I discovered a whole bunch of information about the Bhagavad Gita that was just lost to me. Actually, they had one section there in their essays on it, Modern Contemporaries, and they mentioned Swami Chinmayananda and Paramahansa Yogananda and Paramahansa, and who else is it? Those two prominent persons, yogis, apparently presented the Bhagavad Gita to the Western world. So I was a little dismayed. Finally, I looked through a whole section of this, and there was Sri Aurobindo and Sarvapalli Radhakrishnan and Swami Vivekananda and Swami Chinmayananda and so forth and so on, Ramakrishna and so forth. Swami Shivananda, all these different personalities, Chinmayananda, Paramahansa Yogananda, all these persons, this long list, finally we find at the end A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, the founder of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. He wrote Bhagavad Gita as it is, a commentary on the Gita from one of many perspectives of Gaudiya Vaishnavism. What does that actually say? It's a nice way of saying it. It was an esoteric small cult edition. It's a nice way of saying that. We dismiss one of many perspectives. So it's just one of many, just another commentary. And I was very dismayed by this. I really got, you know, what, you know, they have these little things you can press edit, you know, so I didn't have time, but I wanted to go into it and make a huge, you know, compilation. I did go, however, to Bhagavad Gita as it is. I looked that up on the Google thing, and it was quite extensive. And obviously, some devotees had written this particular section. I found that there were 40 languages printed of Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita. And there were, I didn't find the number of copies currently in print, but I think they go into, what, how many, 15 million or something like that? Any ideas? No? At any rate, something we should check up and update. I noticed that this section on the Bhagavad Gita had been updated on May the 12th. Yeah. So at 12 o'clock in the evening or something. So I'm assuming that was in India. You know, it's already midnight over there, or just as well past midnight now. But someone is working at night in India, updating. So the interesting thing here, the contents for each verse in the book in complete editions includes a Devanagari script, a Latin transliteration, word for word, Sanskrit English meanings, and English, et cetera, as given throughout various, an extensive commentary by Prabhupada is given throughout based on various Gaudiya Vaishnava works, including Ramanuja Bhasha in Sanskrit, Saranta Vishwani Tika, Sanskrit, by Vishwanath Chakravarti, the Gita Bhushana Tika by Baladev Vijayabhusan, and Bhaktivinoda Thakur's Bengali commentaries. Thus the book advocates the path of bhakti towards Krishna, who is seen as identical to Vishnu, in opposition to monistic interpretations. This has led to criticisms from a number of figures who disagree with Prabhupada's literal approach. Can you imagine? Shivaram Swami refutes its criticisms in his book Bhaktivedanta Purports, Perfect Explanations of the Bhagavad Gita, by Torchlight Publishing. Bhagavad Gita is written in the tradition of Gaudiya Vaishnavism, and the members of ISKCON consider the book authoritative and literally true. Like the majority of other Hindu traditions, Gaudiya Vaishnavism regards Bhagavad Gita as the essence of Vedic knowledge and the Upanishads. Some editions of the Gita come with prefaces by Allen Ginsberg and Thomas Merton. So the issue of transcendental and its definition is a curious one. And semantics is playing a part of our understanding, a great part of our understanding. American transcendentalists attempted to achieve a state of transcendental, or transcendental state, by mental speculation, by mental operations. Their objective was to, for a man, for a person, to educate himself by his own actions. And it was a very, you know, wishy-washy philosophy, very unfortunately presented. The American, they got a lot of criticism, even in their own time. And Edgar Allan Poe wrote one criticism, which I thought was interesting. He had an idea that he called them frog ponds, because Walden Pond was, of course, written by Thoreau. Poe called them Walden Pond or frog pondians, and that reminded me of Prabhupada's presentation of the Dr. Frog in the well. They can only see so far. Without the guidance of a bona fide spiritual master, they cannot see beyond their limited material grasp. What they consider transcendental is so far removed from actual from the actual sublime state of being Krishna conscious, being God conscious, so far removed that one wonders, you know, what were they thinking about? It's actually very unclear. Their philosophy is very unclear, and they got a lot of different criticisms about it. So in Krishna consciousness today, we have the objective of spreading this movement, of making people aware of the incredible teachings of our spiritual master, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. He's actually presented to the world a complete and clear understanding of what it means to develop your love for Krishna, develop your love for God. There are so many different ideas. Transcendental meditation also in this country today means TM, how to learn how to meditate and so forth. I remember Ambarish and several other devotees attended an investment presentation by one TM person some years ago about creating a yoga amusement park. And it was pretty dry. You know, all he talked about was the money factor, how much money would be made and so forth. Very briefly outlined who would be presented there. So without knowing and entering into a relationship with Krishna, the transcendental source of all creation, both spiritual and material, one will never understand full transcendence. The transcendence means to leave off attachments to mundane realities, mundane ideas, mundane situations, mundane identities. I'm the mother, I'm the father, I'm the son, I'm the daughter, like this. I'm the American, I'm the male, I'm the female. To give up these attachments to these different identities and develop simply a loving attitude, developing only one attitude, that I'm servant, only one identity, I'm servant of the Supreme Lord. This is our objective in Krishna consciousness. This is our transcendental objective. And unless one enters into that loving exchange between the Supreme Person and himself, he cannot understand what is actually transcendental. Transcendental just becomes a little elevation over the thing, over the mundane situation that we're in. People say, be transcendental. If someone's hungry or something, a child is hungry or something, you might say, be transcendental. You know, don't fuss so much. Of course, a child naturally needs food at all practically at all times. I ran into one devotee in Walmart, and she had a little group of five children with her. And I thought, how do you manage this in Walmart, all these kids together, you know? So, well, I make sure they're well fed, you know, and have plenty of water. So that seems to take care of it. She said that actually is all they really require, is to keep from being grouchy, keep them well fed, you know. So when one actually attempts to fast or deny himself food or is deprived of food or something, the first thing that comes to mind is be transcendental, elevate yourself. But it's very difficult. It's very difficult. But if that's all the transcendental means, is just to elevate oneself over the pains and problems of material life, that's not the real clue. Transcendental means that we're going to enter into this relationship with the Supreme Lord, the cause of all creation. That's a very exciting idea. The verse is basically giving us this opportunity to understand who is Krishna, what is his position. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is telling us, transcendental nature of the Absolute Truth, mind and eyes, is confirmed. In other words, transcendental here means above everything, beyond any concept, any mundane concept. The Supreme Lord is completely free from any material contamination. He is not dependent in any way, shape, or form on the material energy. Many, many philosophies have this idea that God needs us. He needs us to enjoy. He wants us to enjoy because he can't enjoy. He doesn't have a form. He doesn't have it's just a spirit. You know? This is an interesting concept that people preach as a religion, this extreme limitation on God. They put as a religion extreme limitation on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He cannot do this. He cannot do that. When I was incorporating a company, I was in the bank, and I had this check made out, or I was moving a check into an account, and I said the name of the account is Jayan Sringadev Productions. So the lady behind the bank, this is in North Carolina, so you can imagine what her religious affiliation was. She said, well, what does that mean? I said, it means that God comes in the form of half man, half lion. And I knew that was going to take her to another planet. So I said, God can do anything. And she said, that's right. You know. So I was very pleased and very happy that people could understand, yes, God can do anything. Because in many religions, unfortunately, they try to limit God. If you talk with a Muslim about God being a person, no, he's not. God is great. He's too great to be a person. If he's too great to be a person, how come he's missing this personality? So we're concerned. Our concern in Krishna consciousness is to present personalism, not transcendentalism, but more personalism. Because in the personality of God is complete transcendence. If one takes shelter of the personality of God, Godhead, he will achieve complete transcendence. And no other way. There's no other way. To achieve complete transcendence other than surrendering to Krishna. Now what does that mean when you surrender to a person? That's a very Very intimidating idea. You know, if I give my volition, if I give power attorney, I give all these different things to some person, will I be robbed? Will I be destitute? Will I be homeless? You know, this is the natural fear. Now, who can I really trust? You know, some people can't trust their parents. Some people certainly don't trust their children. You know, and so who do you trust? I mean, trust your wife or your husband? No, not a lot. There's not a lot of trust there. So the fact is that the only person you can trust is God. And if you don't believe he's a person, then you really have a problem. You're really at a drift, as they say, a ship adrift without a rudder. There's no way it can point in any direction. It's just going to be blown by the winds. So our concern, our Krishna conscious objective, is to develop this relationship with the Supreme Lord. He has so many potencies. By just glancing over material nature, he becomes many. I don't know exactly how to explain this. Perhaps one of our scholars can explain how the Lord becomes many by glancing over material nature. I could conject, but I'm not going to speculate. But he does this, glancing over material nature. Maybe noted that the Supreme Lord glanced over material nature before the creation of this cosmic manifestation. So material nature was there, but the cosmic manifestation was not there. And by his glancing, only by his glancing, does the cosmic manifestation manifest. So this is our interesting point today, that the Supreme Lord in transcendence, in his perfect transcendence, is giving us the opportunity to recognize him. When we look at nature, as many of the transcendentalists do, they try to commune with nature, the American transcendentalists, they try to commune with nature. They thought that they could understand God, and of course this was also part of the Rousseau teaching, the naturalist teachings, that God is manifest through nature. So we can appreciate that that's true to a large extent. Prabhupada wrote a very nice Bhagavatam study about the Supreme Lord in the form of autumn, the seasons of autumn. And so how the Lord manifests in different ways, how these different manifestations teach us about the Lord. So our understanding is that we can push for a full appreciation of the Supreme Lord only through the teaching, only through, the unblemished teachings of the Supreme Lord as he reveals them to different saints and scholars, and as their conclusion is always along the same lines, that the Supreme Lord, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is Sri Krishna. And he has done all of these different things that we see. He's made this incredible creation. As I was driving over this morning, I was just thinking how beautiful this farm is, how incredibly beautiful this farm is. And I was thinking in my mind, how thankful I am to Manushrestha. Manushrestha basically paid for the farm. At that time, there was no Sankirtan here, but he did Sankirtan. He made very nice cookies. I used to take them to the rest stops around the area here on I-75 and into Georgia sometimes. He made these huge cookies. And he would sell them and make money and give all the money to the temple, basically. So I thanked him. I saw him this morning. I thanked him. Thank you for doing this. This is very kind. You know, you bought the temple. You bought the farm. You know, and he said, yeah, and I'm still paying for it, too. He still pays rent. At any rate, the devotees are always in debt to the Supreme Lord. They never stop being in debt. And that's part of our transcendental position. As servants, you don't leave that position. You don't leave the position of being a servant. You don't serve until you become the master, or you don't serve in such a way that you put the master out of business and you take over his business. That's the objective today in many, many different organizations. But our objective is to constantly and forever be the servant of the Supreme Lord. And this is not an easy undertaking, and it's not is not something that we can readily jump to. It takes years, maybe lifetimes of training to actually understand our identity as a servant of the Supreme Person. So this is our simple class today. I didn't prepare enough. I didn't go into great detail. But somehow or another, we got through it. So thank you. If there's any questions or comments. Yes?
It's Saturday. Sometimes it's a week between the classes. I kind of forgot the gist of who's talking here, and it's in the...
This is Chaitanya Mahaprabhu.
And he's talking to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, and he's making a progressive philosophical presentation to him, establishing... What part of the conversation is it where this is fitting into? Where is he going with this?
I'll have to check. I have his notes on my computer here. Let's see. This. Here we go. This is the liberation of Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, and the next verses.
Is he responding to something that Sarvabhauma said, or is he?
Oh, he's responding to. Previous. Let's see. Let me see who's speaking there. Well, his previous things, text 142, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu continued, whatever Vedic mantras describe the Absolute Truth impersonally only prove in the end that the Absolute Truth is a person. The Supreme Lord is understood in two features, impersonal and personal. If one considers the Supreme Personality of Godhead in both features, he can actually understand the Absolute Truth. He knows that personal understanding is stronger because we see that everything is full of variety. No one can see anything that is not full of variety. That's his first statement. This is everything in the cosmic manifestation emanates from the Absolute Truth, remains in the Absolute Truth, and after annihilation, again enters the Absolute Truth. So, the personal features of the Supreme Personality of Godhead are categorized in three cases, namely, oblative, instrumental, and locative. So, this is the... The personal features of the Supreme Personality of Godhead are categorized in three cases, namely ablative, A-B-L-A-T-I-V-E, instrumental, and locative. I don't generally use those words, no. Locative, I haven't used that ever, I don't think. And ablative, I haven't used that either. So I don't know what I'm talking about. Yeah. There's a purport here. I could read that purport. I might as well do that. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur states in his Amrita Pavava Bhasha that according to the injunction of the Upanishads, the Supreme Absolute Truth is He from whom everything emanates. It is understood that the whole cosmic manifestation emanated from Brahman, the Supreme Absolute Truth. The creation subsists by the energy of the Supreme Brahman, and after annihilation merges again into the Supreme Brahman. From this, we can understand that the Absolute Truth can be categorized in three cases, ablative, instrumental, and locative. According to these three cases, the Absolute Truth is positively personified. In this connection, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati notes the Aitrayana Aitraya Upanishad that he's given a Sanskrit here, but I don't know if there's a translation. No, I'll just go directly to the next section of English. This was the answer given by Father Varuna when questioned by his son, Varuna Bhrigu, about the Absolute Truth. In this mantra, the word Yata, the Absolute Truth, from which the cosmic manifestation is emanated, is in the ablative case that Brahman, by which is universal creation, is maintained, is in the instrumental case, yena, and that Brahman into which the whole cosmic manifestation merges is in the locative case, yat or yasmin. It is stated in the Srimad Bhagavatam, the entire universal creation is contained in the gigantic form of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Everything emanates from him. Everything rests in his energy. And after annihilation, everything merges into his person. So, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, in these verses that we read today, is basically just saying this is how it happens. His mind and his eyes are pure, they're transcendental, and they impregnate the material nature. And this is how the Supreme Lord wishes to become many. He impregnates the material nature. So this is a very exciting idea, which requires a lot of meditation and thought. Do you have any more questions?
I was just saying that it's relating the tattva to the rasa. It'll ultimately, because he enjoys by the variety of many, like as you pointed out, that personalism was because of variety. So he enjoys the living entities, which are part and parcels of himself. He expanded so he could enjoy, and this is impregnation of material nature. And then, like for what we're doing, we know that this is pleasing to Krishna. We're using this material nature in his service, the yukta. As you were pointing out transcendence in your class so nicely today, I was thinking our methodology on that, it seems to be closely related with the word yukta. How do you turn something mundane into transcendental? Is that you engage it in the service of, for us, Srila Prabhupada's, his mercy has given us engagements. And when we engage something in to please Prabhupada according to his directions, and he's pleased, it regains its transcendental nature. So when we're sheltered by Srila Prabhupada's mercy like that, Yesha Prashada Bhagava Prashada, we've actually gained access through his lotus feet or the engagements that we do to please him under his instructions.
Well, the Lord goes on in the next verse, which you'll hear again next week, just to give a little more clarification, this verse that we just read, the Lord refers to the Absolute Truth. He calls it Brahman, the Brahman's eyes and ears, or eyes and mind. And here, in the next verse, the Lord states, the word Brahman indicates the complete Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is Sri Krishna. That is the verdict of all Vedic literature. So that's a very important verse. I think maybe two of these should have been combined because there's a much more lengthy purport to that verse. And the purport I had is very short. But basically, Brahman, when we say Brahman, we're talking about the Supreme Absolute Truth, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna. And that's our take. That's the Gaudiya take on what is Brahman, what is Krishna, what is the Absolute Truth.
There was a definition. It wasn't put as a definition, but for me, it turned into that definition of that. Is I quote this almost all the time now because it stuck with me. Is that Prabhupada explained that pure love for Krishna is intrinsically integrated into all of his energies. So this Brahman is actually pure love for Krishna that's intrinsically integrated. So intrinsically means it's the nature of it. It's his pure love can't be separated from him. So it's actually in everything. So For me, it seems like most of the time Brahman is always used in a reactive statement when you're talking to people with a particular context of impersonalism and Vedic scholarship or something like that. It's never used outside that. The definition of it is used outside of that.
They have a very limited, not transcendental view of Brahman.
And they have to... So when you talk with them, that you use certain vocabulary. But with other people, they give the definition of it to use. A lot of times when you use words, unless you redefine them, people have a predisposed conception of what it is. It's different than yours, and there's not really communication going on a deep level.
Well, one of the cliches of the Mayavadi movement is that everything is Brahman. Yeah, and that's right. But that's as far as they can go. They can't go beyond the Brahman that they see right here. They don't go to the higher realms of Krishna's spiritual world. They are stuck in the material world because they're impersonal. And this is the place for impersonalists. This is where you come when you no longer want to believe that Krishna is the Supreme Person. You want to think, I'm the Supreme Person. So you come here and you go through many different changes being convinced that you're not the Supreme. You get banged around and destroyed. And then you decide, well, everything. God is everything and I am everything. You make all these different, there's so many different takes on Brahman, so many different ideas. But ultimately, unless they include the Supreme Personality of Godhead as the Supreme Brahman, Sri Krishna, unless they actually include that, they're limited and they're not transcendental and they're misleading.
So that's Siddhanta. In other words, where does it go? Where is it the end point?
Yeah, Lord Chaitanya is giving the Siddhanta here.
So we have Bhakti Siddhanta, we have Bhakti Vedanta, that concludes all these points to their topmost position by the mercy of the disciples.
That's right. Yeah. Any other comments or questions? Dhanyavad, ladies? Nothing? Okay. Hare Krishna, glories to Srila Prabhupada. Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.